It's 1 o'clock.
Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody here from Chicago. I'd like to welcome Mr. Ed Harshberger to this podcast. He was a guest previously a few months ago. Ed is a CTO and a senior infosec consultant for a leading cyber firm known as TechSafe Systems. Ed, welcome on board again. And can you kind of just refresh to our audience your background again in case they never listened in to the first podcast?
Absolutely. Thanks, Robbie. It's great to be here. I'm a CTO and senior InfoSec consultant for TechSafe Systems. And as I'd mentioned previously on previous podcasts, so TechSafe is actually a rebranding of Cyronix LLC, or Cyronix Cybersecurity and Consulting. We're a consulting firm that also functions as a what's called an MSP, or a managed security service provider, as well as a compliance company. So we work with a couple of different industries: healthcare, biotech, accounting, finance, to help with regulatory requirements and meeting GRC requirements, which is governance, compliance, or regulatory compliance, and all. And I've done this for many years, 25 plus years in IT and compliance and security. So that's me in a nutshell.
Hey, excellent. Now, you know, Ed, one of your specialties is medical device cybersecurity. And in fact, it's starting to become very much a hot-button topic today. People just don't realize how much that their connected devices, whether it's internal or external to them, are at risk to being hacked into. And unfortunately, we've heard of ransomware attacks, you know, where people, you know, have to pay ransom, this and that. But this can really, literally affect one's life. Just how prevalent is medical device cybersecurity today, in your opinion?
Well, you know, we've heard a lot of, as with any hack or any big breach or anything like that, you know, the news covers the big ones, right? They don't cover the small ones. So, you know, you hear about the hospital systems that may get hacked, like Broadlane and others. And, you know, you may not necessarily know about the smaller hacks. However, they get reported to HHS and JCO and all those guys. You know, there's really two sides to the medical device fence. It's the institutional medical devices, and then it's the personal medical devices that you've got your diabetes care, you've got your heart monitoring, and all those other types of functions that report data back to of course your doctor and those that are monitoring your care level. Now hospitals themselves, of course, as you know, back in the during the WannaCry breach and hack, was very widespread. It was mainly started out of England and the health delivery network there, and mainly when you have those types of targets when they're going after a healthcare institution and looking for vulnerabilities, they're looking for information or either a methodology for delivering rootkits and ransomware or whatnot, so they can get in, they can worm around a little bit, gain some information, and then maybe deploy, ransomware and lock up things so that, you know, it forces the healthcare institution to do something. Medical devices, of course, being around for many, many years, you know, some of these devices have been around 10, 12, 15 years because the way they're built, the way they're coated and all that, they last longer. So, you know, it's really up to the onus of both the medical device manufacturer and the institutions, the healthcare institutions, to make sure that those items are secured.
Okay, excellent. Now, we were talking yesterday in our phone call, and, you know, we were talking, you know, that I was a heart patient about maybe 8-9 years ago, and after my surgery, I was connected to a lot of devices, a lot of tubes and everything. And at that time, I don't think anybody was really worried about those devices being hacked into. But fast forward, you know, 8 or 9 years later, all these devices are now connected to what we call the Internet of Things. Now, is this a correct premise that I'm building this on? I mean, are all these devices really connected to the IoT or only some of them? And if so, doesn't that greatly increase the attack surface for the cyber attacker?
Absolutely, Robbie. Now, I think we have there's the Internet of Things, meaning, you know, those things like your light bulb controller, your thermostat controller, that type of thing. When you say Internet of Things, a lot of people look at, and that's what comes to mind, you know, your Alexa and your all of that. The Internet of Medical Things is more so where you are connected back to a provider or an organization that's gathering data on your well-being. Like you said, much like you said with the heart monitoring and if you have a pacemaker or an embedded defibrillator, you know what, it's interesting that when you consider that, because you got to think about how that device is connected back. One of the things I was encouraged to see, my dad years ago, he had a connected defibrillator pacemaker that he had gotten at Duke, and the really good thing about the way they connected that was they connected the monitor itself and then to a base station, and then the base station would dial in or over internet connect back into the Duke delivery network. And that's where you got to be very careful and critical about how that happens. You know, I was looking the other day because I knew we were going to talk about this, and I'm just trying to see if I had any specific examples of where you had actually malintent for somebody going and messing with something like a defibrillator or a heart monitor, out in the wild, if you will, you know, out and about, that's not in a controlled environment like the hospital environment or healthcare environment, and not really, there wasn't really a good example of that as much as it is. When that data gets to the main system where you have multiple patients, you have all their data being collected for the cardiologist or the primary care physicians to review, that's where it really gets concerning. And so you have to have that data quite secured, the perimeter secured, all those types of things like that. Now, it's not to say that you can't do that. It's not to say you can't go for a specific device, but you would have to know that a certain person has a certain type of device, the connectivity around that. And I think the danger is more so that if the main system, the main server with all the data and all the analytics, if that's compromised, I think that's where you can really get into trouble or cause an issue if you're changing any of the parameters of the device itself once it connects back and delivers its status and its data. I think you have to be very, very cautious of that. Does that make sense?
Yep, Yep, sure does. Now, Ed, you know, we've all heard about the Food and Drug Administration. Now, what is their role with medical device cybersecurity? What kind of pre- and post-market guidance do they offer to healthcare providers and to the vendors that make these devices?
Exactly. So back in about 2016 and 2018, the FDA started really cranking out guidelines. And, of course, with the guidelines, it says, you know, what you should do in best practice and standards. For the most part, it doesn't necessarily define how you do that or the standards the methods in which you go about meeting that those guidelines, and they're for oversight as well. So, you know, like. For instance, a medical device manufacturer can put together what's called a cybersecurity framework, which addresses the device itself, making assessments, looking for vulnerabilities and risk management, then turning around and then saying, okay, this is what we found, and we have classified these findings. From low, medium, high to critical, and how we're going to address those and take this information to developers and R&D and how we can mitigate it within the devices itself. And then ongoing monitoring and ongoing improvements that may need to be done, for that. So that's how I've used, the post-market guidance for a lot of the projects that we've worked on. And we worked on projects for a lot of companies like, some biodiagnostic and infectious disease control detection companies and microbiology companies, as well as companies like BMRU, who is a manufacturer of microbiology and RNA DNA testing devices. And this is the lab. Worked with Abbott Healthcare and in their rapid diagnostics division, where you have medical device or laboratory devices and testing devices that are in the clinics with the physicians. Your primary care physicians, your stat. Or very, very quick response testing that you need to do in the ER, and that type of thing. Those types of scenarios, and you've got where you have to consider the information around how to handle the assessment of each of those devices, what the remediation roadmap looks like. How they function, how the company reports that either into quality by either one, it's sharing this information between the information security team that's responsible for the medical device, the R&D team and developers that are going in, and they're either refactoring their code. And doing those things and updating the devices, as well as quality and regulatory control, so that in the event there's a customer complaint or a sentinel event per se, where something may have gone wrong and it gets reported to the company, they have to open up a corrective action plan, and then they go through that. So having a medical device cybersecurity framework within the medical device industry is critical, so that you've got a map across all those segments that I just mentioned. Does that make sense?
Yep, sure does. Well, that kind of now segues into this other question I want to ask. You know, the cybersecurity industry, we have who knows how many standards, right? And a lot of them come from NIST. We have this framework, that framework. When it comes to medical device cybersecurity, what are really some of the more specific frameworks? If you can just name a couple of them and how they relate, that'd be great.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now, you know, I've seen where we've employed segments of a couple different really strong frameworks. Now, of course, the strongest one that's out there right now is, of course, the NIST framework, the National Institute of Standards. You know, the 800 series, the COBIT-5 frameworks for monitoring and putting in those types of monitoring systems and reporting systems. And then, of course, for, like, laboratory testing devices, medical devices, there's the CLSI Auto 11. Auto 11 is one of the standards that a lot of the medical devices companies came together to write standard protocols that are related to the devices that they're providing, you know, and these are folks that are actually, you know, the lab folks, folks that are medical technologists, those types of things. They went and they wrote the best practice standard or the best monitoring standards in Auto 11. So that's just a sample of some of the frameworks and standards that you can employ in your holistic cybersecurity framework.
Okay, excellent. I didn't realize there were so many frameworks for medical device cybersecurity. Wow. Now, when it comes to your clients, Ed, are there any client success stories you'd like to share with us? Of course, not giving away any confidential information, but are there any testimonials or anything you'd like to share with us, with the audience?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't talk about some of the specific projects, but I can tell you that, you know, at TechSafe, we work with medical device and biopharma clients to help them put in these frameworks for to put in controls, to put in to make assessments, and then to help them develop these remediation roadmaps. And we've had worked with a large pharmaceutical company that was doing a lot of protein analysis and those types of things, and they also worked remotely with out of the country teams for analysis and all of that as well. So we're able to put a few controls into place, as well as making sure that they're following a proper procedure for securing the data that they're collecting from both the laboratory testing itself, pre-market, and as they're trading the data between their partners who are also doing some of their analytics to the data they're collecting. For instance, if you're looking for a specific protein or genotype combination when you're formulating a medication or a drug, in order to act against a viral variant or a bacterial variant or something like that, you know, that's the type of data that, you know, it's one, it's IP. Intellectual property for the company, but it's also sometimes they're in clinical trials, so sometimes they have to go and they're extracting some of these data types, and it's tied to a participant within the program, and they have to protect that data as well. So we've had pretty good success with working with companies like that, with, you know, end-to-end cybersecurity frameworks and monitoring the security behind their data transmissions and securing their IP. From the medical device end, we've worked with several companies like blood analyzers, coagulation detection devices, and that type of thing, in order to secure their connectivity both both within the device itself, within the analyzers itself, as well as interfacing technologies when they're talking to enterprise systems like your laboratory information systems or your laboratory information management systems, as well as electronic medical records or decision support systems. So that's part of the operations that we help our clients with on a daily basis.
Okay, excellent. Now, how do you define accessories to a medical device that will impact their security? Is there something that healthcare providers should be aware of, need more education? And could you please elaborate a little bit more on that?
Absolutely, and thanks for that question, Robbie, because this is actually a very important topic. You have medical devices themselves, the analyzers, like a blood analyzer, a chemistry analyzer, or handheld sputum analyzers, or those types of things. Those are obviously of concern to their manufacturers and to the healthcare institution in and of itself. What I think you really also need to look at is your connectivity methodologies. How you're using an interface box, and when I say an interface box or some kind of middleware, a lot of times you'll have a computer that's connected to an analyzer. The computer itself is running some kind of analytic information on the sample that's being fed to it from the analyzer itself, and then from there it's going to another device that is brokering the connectivity to the outside, to the enterprise, meaning the laboratory information system or the medical record system or that type of thing. And I think you have to look at that from an end-to-end standpoint, right? And that's why I say those are typically, sometimes they're considered accessories, sometimes they're considered non-accessories, but they still perform a vital function of getting the data from an analyzer or an analyzer system to whatever enterprise system that needs that information to help the clinicians and the professionals make these decisions for care, decisions on care. That's why I call it, decision support. And what that means is you got to be careful with the type of connectivity and what messaging you're sending to across the wire. The data, is the data encrypted in transit? Is the data encrypted at rest? Is it how many brokerage points or how many middleware points is it running through? That type of thing. And I think you have to look at that whole program and address that, as well as the way that the software is running on the analyzer. And like I said, a lot of times these analyzers, they last many, many years. And, of course, they put out updates and firmware updates and that type of thing. One of the things I learned by working with a major diagnostic device provider was we looked at, when providing firmware, how do you validate that that's actually from the developers at that company? And that's where things like code signing come in, you know, so that when before you do an update, the system can validate by some kind of encrypted key or whatnot that's indeed validated firmware from the manufacturer. And all because, you know, we have documented cases where, you know, hackers and malicious actors have used firmware upgrades to do code injection or to do, you know, some type of unloading of malware, which will infect the devices or infect the computers connected to the devices. So that's why I'm highly proponent on a holistic methodology when we're talking about a cybersecurity framework from end to end, meaning not just the device, but any of the middleware that's connected to the device and any of the connectivity that's around that.
Okay, excellent. Now, Ed, from your experience, what seems to be more hacked into the internal devices, like if a patient's wearing a pacemaker, or is it the external devices, like the dialysis machines, for example?
I think more so, and again, we're talking about compromised systems and not necessarily targeted, right? So, you know, it's the kind of the shotgun effect. And like I was mentioning earlier, I haven't been able to come across any cases where someone had been arrested for hacking in and trying to essentially harm a patient directly, knowingly know that, yes, they've got an implant or defibrillator or heart monitor or that type of thing. Not to say that can't happen, and I think that can happen as a result of compromising the main system. So I think when you're a lot of times the attackers are looking, okay, they're looking for monetary gain, either social hacktivism or something along those lines. There's some broad reason for doing that. I guess, and because of that, I think that you're looking at more along the lines of institutional-based systems, as well as any of the, you know, software as a service or the systems that are like home-based that report into a SaaS system or a hosted data collection system that's hosted that you know that a company or a provider can use that as an analytical tool or a decision support for care or that type of thing. So I'm not thinking it's necessarily targeting, not to say we won't see that. I think we need to be very cognizant of the things that are implanted in patients, the wearables, and the methodologies that they use to broadcast that data or get their settings from those hosted or those, as I call them, you know, the mothership programs. Does that make sense?
Okay. Oh, excellent, yeah. Now, as we were having this podcast, I'm kind of remembering back in the days before my open-heart surgery, I had to sign a bunch of paperwork, and the surgeon and the nurse, they had to read off to me the whole list of risks and everything. I'm kind of thinking now that the doctors and their state, the day will come when they're going to have to warn patients of the cyber risks during an operation. Do you think it's possible a cyber attacker can actually launch a cyber attack in the middle? Suppose, for example, the heart bypass surgery, is that not unfathomable or just going to the extreme, which, you know, I mean, maybe I'm being a little paranoid about, or what do you think about that?
You know, I don't think that's paranoid, Robbie. I think it's a valid concern. I think anytime you deal with any technology, I think you really need to be cognizant of what that technology capability is. For instance, like you said, you could be having, you know, We're moving into the age where we have robotic surgery now, right? So, a surgeon in the UK can be working on a patient in New York via robot, by telemedicine, you know, and would that connection get compromised? Would the system that's running the robot get compromised? Can it be? Sure, you know, I think anything man-made can be compromised. I think you have to think that way. I think you always have to be thinking about, okay, what could happen, or what precautions can we take to mitigate something as much as possible? Because, you know, a lot of times when we have crises, there's someone will ultimately say, well, you know, I didn't even think that would happen, or somebody would actually do that. But, you know, you kind of have to be a little bit paranoid. You have to be a little bit always on alert, because that could happen.
No, as we wrap
up. And as far as like you're, I think. Oh, I'm sorry. I think you were mentioning.
No, go ahead,
you know, you're right, because when I had a stent put in a couple of years ago, and I remember going through, like you said, the doctor talking about, okay, this is the worst case scenario, or this is what could happen, you know. The likelihood is low, but I got to tell you about it because it's a possibility, right? And I think you got the same thing. I think when somebody goes in for, you know, any type of automated surgeries or those types of things, I think, you know, they are going to have to tell them about that and say, hey, you know, this is a possibility, probably won't happen, but hey, you know, just keep, you know. So I think that awareness is good, but I think that we can put some things in place. We can put some security controls. We can put some human controls in place that actually deter that kind of activity, if you will.
Okay. Now, Ed, as we start to wrap up our show here, what can healthcare organizations do to help mitigate the risk of cyber attacks on medical devices? Is there a laundry list you tell your clients, or is there specific one or two items that they can do? What can be done?
Well, this is encouraging, because a few years ago, a lot of your medical institutions, your hospitals, your healthcare delivery networks, and whatnot, started out sending out what's called ISAs, which is the Information Security Assessment. And you have that along with, you know, HIMSS, the Healthcare Information Management Systems Society, which is very, very prevalent within the medical industry. They've come out with documentation that you can make sure that your medical device manufacturer, prior to buying it, or most times it's prior to buying it, they'll ask for at least that. It's a medical device, MDS2, medical device specification or medical device disclosure, manufacturer's disclosure. So having that along with a healthcare system or a hospital providing an ISA, and you know, they invariably, they're built by different healthcare institutions, so some of them are longer than others or whatnot, more complete. That documenting that information is critical. Another thing that I noticed that University of Pennsylvania Medical Center does is every time they have a device that comes in-house, they put it on quarantine, they scan it, they test it for about a week or two to look for any kind of anomalous behavior, malicious behavior, any of those types of things like that, and then to see what kind of things that it may be open to. That's another methodology that I, you know, I recommend and I've performed is doing that type of thing. So the other thing I would do is taking inventory and really looking at what you've in place in the labs, in each of the critical care departments, those types of things to see, okay, one, what's the rating, and give them ratings, like what's the rating of this device, you know, and then what is it connected to and how is it connected to, and then evaluate that all the way down the line. Now, I know that's a lot of work, but in the long run, knowing all that information up front can really prevent a lot of issues.
Okay. Excellent. Now, Ed, what's the best way for someone to contact in case they need help with medical device cybersecurity, or they just have some questions they want to ask you?
Absolutely, and I appreciate that, Robbie. They can go to our website at techsafe.systems. So it's techsafe.systems with an S. Or they can call our toll-free number at 877-240-5435. Or they can just simply email us at consulting@techsafe.systems. And that's three ways that they can get a hold of us. And we do, you know, free consultations all the time. We want to understand what the client needs prior to, you know, really getting deep into the weeds with it, so that, you know, what they're getting into, what they're looking at, that type of thing. So, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have medical staff certified medical staff on our board, as well as we have our CEO is an RN, RN informaticist actually, and IDLE and Epic certified. So we have a really deep bench that we can provide services and consultations.
Excellent. Well, you know, I mean, medical device cybersecurity is going to be becoming an explosive topic. And Ed, in that regard, we'd love to have you again next month, again, to talk about another area of medical device cybersecurity so you can share your knowledge with our audience. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Robbie. I would really look forward to that. Yeah, actually, and I'd like to talk more in depth into how to put a framework together. I think that would be valuable to the audience.
Sounds excellent. We look forward to having you, Ed, and have a great afternoon.
Thanks for the invitation. It's great talking to you, Robbie. Thanks a lot.
Take care, bye.